Of all the end-of-the-year honors and best-of-the-year lists, we think we have found the most dishonorable. It's from the fact-checking website of the St. Petersburg Times, PolitiFact.com. PolitiFact, which sweeps the Augean stables of American political discourse, rating politician statements for truth, falsehood, or some alloy of the two, has declared its first annual Lie of the Year. And joining us to announce the winner is Bill Adair, the editor of PolitiFact. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And you have to explain to us why you folks at PolitiFact.com decided to name a Lie of the Year.
Well, we felt it was a great year for lying. There were really an extraordinary number of falsehoods in the political discourse that we found in our fact-checking. We checked about 428 claims in the year, and we found that 26% were false, and an additional 10% earned our lowest rating, pants on fire. So it was a very good year for lying, and we felt it was important to sort of name one as the lie of the year.
So, in a year that more generally may be remembered as the year of my kid is in that balloon, or we were invited to the state dinner, you've gone through politician statements, and you heard it first. The first annual PolitiFact.com Lie of the Year is...
death panels. The claim by Sarah Palin that the health care bill includes death panels that would make some determination of whether people could live or die. We decided that was the lie of the year because not only was it so inaccurate, but it spread so widely, and it became a really important talking point in the debate about the health care bill. It really helped, I think, define the health care bill for a lot of people, even though it was wrong. And in many ways, the Democrats spent much of the late summer and early fall fighting the death panel claim and other falsehoods rather than defining the bill themselves.
And how well have you done at tracing the origins of this particular whopper that there are death panels written up in the health care bill?
It was actually Palin herself, as far as we can tell, who was the first to use the phrase death panels. But the concept that the Democratic plan might somehow promote euthanasia actually goes back to the early part of the year to an editorial in the Washington Times that suggested that. And it picked up a lot of steam in the summer when Betsy McCoy, who is a former New York State official who speaks up a lot on healthcare issues, she raised this euthanasia question and suggested that that the seniors would be encouraged to die sooner. And we rated that also pants on fire. I should note that the death panel's claim from Governor Palin was also rated pants on fire on our truth meter. And so it definitely sort of evolved. But it was Palin who gave it the phrase death panels, and that really launched it into the stratosphere.
And in the event that death panels should be unable to perform their duties in the course of the year, who would be first runner-up and who might take over as lie of the year?
First runner-up would be Glenn Beck. We rate a lot of pundits on PolitiFact.com, and we spent a lot of time this year checking some of the talk show hosts from MSNBC and Fox and CNN. And Glenn Beck was the runner-up for a claim about John Holdren, who was the White House science advisor. And Beck had claimed that Holdren in the past had proposed forced abortion and putting sterilants in the water. One also earned a pants on fire.
Well, Bill Adair, thank you very much for breaking the lie of the year, death panels, right here on All Things Considered.
It's a big moment, Robert. thanks for having me.
Okay, we can read all about it at PolitiFact.com. Bill Adair is the editor. He's also Washington Bureau Chief for the St. Petersburg Times.
The most anticipated movie of the year may be Avatar, the nearly $300 million epic from writer and director James Cameron. The director of Titanic and The Terminator spent years helping to develop digital 3D camera systems and has used them to create an entirely computer-generated world. Pandora, a lush moon in a nearby solar system. Film critic David Edelstein has returned from Pandora with this review.
As the budget of Avatar grew otherworldly and few saw footage, Hollywood watchers began to speculate that the new, largely computer-generated James Cameron movie would be a Titanic disaster. But they shouldn't have doubted him. That trademark Cameron blend of jaw-dropping technology, grandiosity, and cornball populism is back and mightier than ever. The film is dizzying, enveloping, vertigo-inducing. I ran out of celebratory adjectives an hour into its 161 minutes. Now, it's also on one level a crock, predictable, sentimental, and tin-eared. Cameron has given us a parable that's a barely disguised rewrite of American history. Native Americans, in the form of the blue, 10-foot Navi people of Pandora, a moon of the vast gas planet Polyphemus, battle expertly against white capitalist imperialists who want to drive them from their ancestral lands. The year is 2154, and a Marine named Jake Sully, played by the personable Sam Worthington, works for a military-industrial behemoth that's mining Pandora for a rare mineral called, get this, unobtainium. Jake has his nervous system projected into a remotely controlled Navi body called an avatar for the purposes of mingling with the natives. And it's when he's tall and blue that the film goes into full-scale computer mode. Back in the world of flesh and blood actors, a prickly scientist played by Sigourney Weaver, who totally holds her own against the 10-foot-tall blue thingies, wants Jake to study Navi rituals. She's funded by the company, but has a humanist agenda. But a selfish executive played by Giovanni Ribisi calls the Navi blue monkeys, and since their sacred land sits over a vast supply of unobtainium, he wants Jake to convince the tribe to decamp. Jake has to keep a video diary of his life as an avatar, and as he speaks about trying to learn the Navi language, Cameron cuts to his lessons with the fiery female warrior Neytiri, who under all the computer imagery is modeled on actress Zoe Saldana.
This is video log 12 times 21, 32. Do I have to do this now? Like, I really need to get some rec.
No, now, when it's fresh.
Okay, location, shack, and the days are starting to blur together. The language is a pain, but, you know, I figure it's like field stripping a weapon. Just repetition, repetition.
Navi.
Nari.
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 Doing it all stronger.
Neytiri calls me Scown. It means moron.
It's obvious that under the spell of this mystical culture, Jake will go native, and that Avatar will become a fantasy land dances with wolves. Actually, dances with Thanators and Banshees and Dire Horses and Leonopteryxes. But the story would be ho-hum without the spectacle. The problem with computer-generated imagery is it usually doesn't make the final perceptual leap. It's impressive rather than immersive. But Cameron has moved the boundary posts. My press kit mentions, among other inventions, a new image-based facial performance capture, more intricate head rig systems, a simulcam, and an amplified mobility platform suit, or AMP. But Cameron also has old-fashioned compositional savvy. He puts enormous things in the foreground, trees, waterfalls, creatures, and adds layers of texture and movement reaching back into the frame. He creates a living ecosystem, and you and your 3D glasses are there. The technology helps put over the movie's central idea that this world Pandora, with its bioluminescent ground and foliage, is alive and infused with sacred energy. The Na'vi have long waists, reptilian tails, golden eyes, and wide noses. At first, I found them an eyesore. But about halfway through, the humans began to seem puny and pallid by comparison. Jake becomes more attracted to them, too, especially toward the Amazonian Neytiri. He says as an avatar, he's in the true world. It's his human world that's the dream. He says, I don't know who I am. Who he is, of course, is a born-again Indian fighting for the pure and primitive against the poisonous forces of technology, with the help, of course, of state-of-the-art cinematic technology. Clods of dirt fly into our faces. Colors are more colorful. Big beasts, bigger and more bestial. Warplanes, more terrifyingly warlike. Cameron is said to be an obsessive, even a megalomaniac. But I bow to his titanic will. Now, he's king of a world he made from scratch.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about computer data and all the data that's out there. We talked a lot about the cell phone, your cell phone that you have, but you are bombarded with, we're all bombarded with lots of data thrown at us all day long. You wake up in the morning, you turn on your radio or your TV, you flip through your paper as you drink your coffee. You listen to music on the train or in your car. You leaf through a magazine. You watch the billboards and you overhear someone else's annoying cell phone conversation. If you add all that stuff up, all the TV shows, books, movies, text messages, podcasts, web pages, whew, that's a lot of data. But how much is it, right? We're talking science. Somebody's got to quantify it. Well, we have somebody who's been looking at it. And this was a report that comes from the University of California in San Diego called How Much Information? And my next guest is one of the authors. Roger Bone is professor of technology management at the UC San Diego, also director of the Global Information Industry Center there. He joins us from the university. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Bone.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You're very welcome. How much data is out there? How much are we exposed to every day?
Well, we estimate that an average person on an average day is getting about 34 gigabytes of data, which is a number that's a little hard to grasp, but it's five DVDs.
It's a whole giant hard drive.
We don't store it. We couldn't possibly store it. It goes in one eye and out the other. Even more incredible to me was 100,000 words per day,
wow,
either read or heard.
Did that surprise you when you came up with those figures?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, bytes, it's hard to relate to, but 100,000 words sounds like a lot.
Mm-hmm. And do we know where most of it's coming from?
Yes, we do. Television is still the biggest single source. It's about 40% in terms of words and bytes. Oddly enough, a lot of the bytes come from computer games, which is something that has not been studied much at all. So the data there is a little bit uncertain. But the words are then distributed among a whole bunch of other sources, including a lot from radio, a certain amount from reading, and so forth.
So reading still is popular.
There is still reading, although actually what we found is that the amount of reading has increased since 1980, which was our base year. But the reason is people are now reading on the internet. They're not reading in print anymore, or they're reading less in print and quite a lot on the internet.
And their handwriting a lot less, I'll bet.
Well, who does that anymore at all?
Why do you need to know? Why do you need to measure all these streams of data?
Well, it's interesting to know the relative proportions from different sources, and also the growth rate was quite surprising. I was expecting it to grow at kind of a Moore's Law rate, and in fact, it's only been growing a few percent per year. So that's either a missed opportunity, or it's telling us that people don't actually care that much about getting the latest high-resolution graphics in their everyday life. They more care about the content, which is not particularly byte-intensive.
Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff gets compressed these days, the data itself.
Yes, we measured the compressed stream, which was one of the measurement decisions we had to make. So, for example, your cell phone transmits at a lower rate than your conventional phone. It's 10 kilobits per second on the cell phone and about five times that on a regular phone, which was it's interesting, and it's reflected somewhat in the quality of cell phone calls, which is not as good.
All this data that's getting thrown at us, and what did you say, 34 gigabytes or something like that, what do we do with it? Can we make any useful information out of it, or is there a difference between the data and knowledge that we take away from all this data?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we didn't measure how much of it is assimilated. We measured how much reaches your eyeballs. Mm-hmm. Passing through into your brain, we didn't try to count that. And being retained, obviously, it's only a tiny fraction of that. People have information sources on in the background when they're driving, or they have the radio on when they're using the computer, whatever. It doesn't mean they're actually paying attention to this. And a lot of it's just entertainment in one form or another.
You've now mentioned your eyeballs twice. Does that mean our ears are not important anymore?
Well, in terms of bytes, our ears are not important. In terms of words, our ears are very important. Mm-hmm. In terms of byte measurements, the only thing that really adds up is moving pictures.
I see. Interesting how you've parsed that out. How do you handle multitasking? We're all into multitasking. Like if I'm watching TV and I'm surfing the internet, which is, people have their laptops on, right? One of them is serving background at any one time. How do you handle
that's
this?
Right.
Does that count as information consumption, even if I'm not paying attention to it?
Yes, the way we measured it, it's stuff you were exposed to, and you may or may not have paid attention to it. We have different data sources for different streams of data, so we couldn't really take care of the double counting. We have double counting in our data. We say an average of 12 hours per day, but it's probably more like 10 hours per day plus another 2 hours of double tasking.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you expected the byte consumption to be like Moore's law, but it's actually going up very slowly.
Yes.
Why is that? I would think that it would be exponentially being bombarded with this stuff.
It's about 5%. It's only been growing at about 5% per year on a per capita basis. Mm-hmm. And the first reason, of course, is the number of hours in the day is fairly finite, not totally finite, but it's limited. So our consumption went up from 7 hours in 1980 to 12 hours now, mm-hmm. Which is a very slow rate of growth spread out over 25 years. But the other big factor is the television technology has progressed very, very slowly. Mm-hmm. We looked at 2008. There's some HD TV in the 2008 data. But even HDTV, in terms of byte streams, is only about three times better than conventional television. So that is not going up at a Moore's law rate. It's the old technology lock-in problem. Once you have a standard set, everything sticks to that standard, and it slows down the rate of change.
But interestingly enough, you're as you said before, that your results suggest that the idea that we're obsessed with computers now is entirely true. We're still obsessed with television.
That's where a lot of the time is going, although it's there certainly are some age patterns in television consumption, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. The most television is consumed by retired people, as far as I can tell.
Is that right? You mean kids do not watch television anymore?
Well, they watch a lot less than their elders.
Mm-hmm. They time shift.
They time shift, and the average teenager watches less than 4 hours a day, whereas the average person in the 60 to 70 age bracket is watching about 7 hours per day.
Mm. And I guess advertisers watch these numbers very carefully.
Yes, and as you know, there's all kinds of efforts to figure out how to advertise on the internet.
Does your research suggest any upper limit to the amount of information that we can consume at all, our brains are able to hold?
Well, we didn't look at what the brain is holding. And there is a lot of interesting research where people look at fMRI scans of people and absorbing information and see what they're retaining and so forth. Certainly, there appear to be limits to that. What's happening now is we're getting more and more stuff thrown at us, probably about the same amount as sticking as before, although it's really hard to tell.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Gordon in Honolulu. Hi, Gordon.
Greetings, gentlemen. I'd like to point out that people that are blind are really challenged by the society we live in. A lot of the data is not accessible. Even the devices for accessing data are not accessible. And it's one of the things we really have to work with and going forward into the future.
I take it from this that you are blind yourself.
Yes, I am.
And so this is a good question, and this is a good problem for people who are blind. How do we reach them? Roger, any suggestions?
Well, it's words. A lot of words are still taken in through the ears, but a lot more are taken in through reading. So that's definitely an issue. And as you know, there are assistive technologies with computer programs of various kinds. I'm not sure how well they really work, though.
Gordon, do you have a suggestion?
Well, yes, indeed. You know, the standards is the problem. The large corporate entities that control a lot of the technological innovation really do limit, you know, how rapidly we adapt. And I'd like to see a time in which we pay append to the people, places, and objects in our world the data, a tag that one could use to link to the knowledge of the world. Instead of having the genie in the bottle on your desk or in your living room, you could just encounter it, discover it in the world as you move about.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for calling.
You bet.
Good suggestion. 1-800-999-8255. So where are we headed with this, Roger? Where is this all going?
Well, it's going to increase the amount of so-called multitasking goes up, as you've probably talked with other guests on this show. The research suggests that people aren't really understanding multiple streams of information simultaneously nearly as much as they think they are.
They're crashing with their cars a lot more.
And they're crashing, absolutely, they're crashing with their cars, and they're not paying attention to me in class, darn it.
You actually can notice the difference.
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, one of the anomalies in the information age is the face-to-face lecture still seems to be a good way of imparting information. Why on earth should that be true? Mm-hmm. And clearly there's something about our nature, our social nature, or the ability to pay attention to nonverbal cues that works better in a face-to-face situation.
Mm-hmm. So you find yourself having to put up with people who are sitting there with their laptops and not paying attention to you.
Well, I can cold call them and things like that. But obviously, they make their own decisions. I teach in graduate school and everybody's an adult. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we go to faculty meetings and some people sit around checking our iPhones.
Mm-hmm. When you collect all this data, does something like that enter in a lot? If you're driving your car and you look at the location of your car, the billboards I'm looking at, the tweets I'm doing at the same time, do you count all those as separate streams?
That is a good question. No, we're only looking at artificial data that is presented to people, not the what you see naturally. And unfortunately, I could not figure out a way to measure face-to-face conversation.
Is that right?
Yeah, I would love to do that, because if you think of face-to-face conversation as something that people used to be really good at and they would do it for hours after dinner, it's possible the amount of information we receive in bytes has actually gone down.
Interesting. We're talking with Roger Bowen this hour on Science Friday from NPR News. So what does it take for you to measure that stuff?
Well, we need better models of how people assimilate information. There are estimates of the equivalent of a face-to-face conversation. As you know, probably know, Cisco has a video conferencing system. So we can put rough numbers on that. On the other hand, what I'd really like to know is how did people spend their time 100, 200, 1,000 years ago? And that, unfortunately, is before we started recording anything. Yeah. So that's going to be very hard to figure out.
Well, good luck to you, Roger. And
have
a happy holiday. Happy New Year to you.
Thanks very much.
Roger Bowen is professor of technology management at the University of California, San Diego, and director of the Global Information Industry Center there.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. President Obama announced today that he had reached an agreement on global warming with many of the world's leaders. The announcement caps two tense weeks of negotiations in Copenhagen. The deal has not been formally approved by the 193 nations at the conference, and the details of the plan aren't yet public. But the agreement apparently breaks a deadlock that threatened to doom the talks. Joining us from the Copenhagen conference is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. And Richard, President Obama called this a meaningful and unprecedented breakthrough. How meaningful is it? What does it say?
Well, actually, we just got a hold of it. It's a slim 3 pages. It's much less than the enormous documents being negotiated here throughout the last couple of weeks. It's important to say it's a political declaration. It's not a legally binding treaty. But the main elements are, first, countries will list the actions they are pledging to take to combat global warming, to reduce their emissions. Second, countries agree to share information so the world can judge if they are meeting those commitments. That was a huge sticking point between the U.S. and China that's been resolved here. And third, it sets as a guideline limiting global warming to no more than 2-degree increase over pre-industrial levels. It's a really bare-bones outline. It's important to note that this is not a binding treaty, and also that countries get to set their own targets. And in fact, the president acknowledged that the pledges that have been put on the table to date aren't enough to stop global warming. Here's the president speaking at a news conference tonight.
Now, this progress did not come easily, and we know that this progress alone is not enough. Going forward, we're going to have to build on the momentum that we've established here in Copenhagen to ensure that international action to significantly reduce emissions is sustained and sufficient over time.
Well, Richard, tell us how the meeting finally got to this point tonight after 2 weeks of what seemed to be really bitter fighting there.
Yeah, it's been an amazing couple of weeks, and ministers and secretaries of state were here throughout last night. They were negotiating almost all night, and they were supposed to have a text this morning for presidents and prime ministers to sign, but they just couldn't do it. Mr. Obama arrived, and he was supposed to give a speech, but instead he plunged right into a series of meetings, first with 19 other world leaders, and then he spent some time with China Premier Wen Jiabao, and then more time with world leaders, and just back and forth and back and forth all afternoon, and finally towards the end of the day, he came out with this document.
Richard, I've been reading reaction from environmental groups calling this a shameful, abject failure, a toothless agreement. What are you hearing there from people about whether this at all meets expectations people had coming in?
Yes, I've certainly read those as well. And I think there are some environmental groups that are more positive about it, actually, considering this could have been a complete disaster. This is at least forward progress to some degree, some argue. Clearly, there were a lot of people who were hoping for a lot more. Small island nations, for example, wanted global warming increase to be limited to 1.5 degrees centigrade, not 2, and that figure is certainly not in this document. Poor nations wanted a huge outpouring of money to help them, and part of this package would create a fund that would eventually provide $100 billion a year for them, which is a lot of money, but not as much as some studies show is needed to help them. And on the other hand, it does seem to reach the compromise between the U.S. and China over openness and transparency, although as we look at the text, it really seems that the U.S. gave up significant ground in its original position to get this deal.
Okay, NPR's Richard Harris at the Climate Summit in Copenhagen. Richard, thank you very much.
Good to talk to you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Here in Washington, D.C., a winter storm is apparently on the way, so what better sports topic for the cold weather than baseball? At least that's what our regular commentator, Stefan Fatsis, has been thinking about. Stefan, good to talk with you once again.
Hello, Robert.
And Bud Selig, Commissioner of Baseball, this week announced the formation of a committee to examine just about anything it wants to examine about baseball. Stefan, what do you think of that committee?
Well, I think it's a good idea to do something like this. And he put 14 people on this committee, several centuries of baseball knowledge, and some really smart, open-minded people, Joe Torre, Tony La Russa, some good front office executives. Having said that, of this group, 13 are over the age of 50. All of them are men. 13 of them are white. The only non-baseball official is 68-year-old conservative political columnist George Will. No players, no umpires, no union officials. Look, 27% of the players in baseball are Latino. How about a respected Latino player like Bernie Williams, the former Yankees outfielder? Mm-hmm. How about a recently retired player, Tom Glavine, Greg Maddux, Tony Gwynn? How about a smart under 40 executive? How about Kim Ang of the Los Angeles Dodgers, the odds-on choice to become the first female general manager in baseball? And if you're going to include a writer, how about one of these quantitatively minded guys who are rationally dissecting every facet of the sport? You know, there's nobody here who came of age in the internet era. This is Eisenhower era people.
All right. Well, that's your thoughts on who's on the committee. What about what the committee is going to talk about? What do you think they'll actually do?
How much they can accomplish is questionable because of the factors of other outside forces, like the players' union, which will have to approve most changes to the game on the field, like the television networks, which will have to approve any changes in the schedule, particularly in the postseason. But a couple of things are obvious here. One is the length of games. about 2 hours and 50 minutes now. There's a belief that you could really get back to a point where games didn't last more than 2.5 hours, maybe limit conferences between the pitchers and the catchers and the managers on the mound, force hitters not to step out of the batter's box constantly. Another big issue is instant replay. This was big news after a series of blown calls by umpires in the playoffs. I hope baseball takes a step forward here.
Would they consider making the designated hitter uniform, either in both leagues or none?
If they move to go that direction, it's going to have to be uniform in both leagues. The players' union will never allow the reduction of a roster spot.
One other subject, golf. The PGA commissioner, Tim Fitchum, put a brave face on the news that Tiger Woods will be taking a break from playing. How much trouble is the PGA Tour in right now?
You know, Fincham said that he was more concerned with the recession than with Tiger leaving, but it's a double whammy for golf. The sport has 11 tournaments who have sponsors that are due to expire after the 2010 season. Three tournaments on the schedule have no sponsors right now. Last year, when Tiger was out with that knee injury, the TV audience for tournaments that he had played in the previous year fell from 4.6 million on average to 2.4 million, almost 50%. That means advertising buyers argue for lower rates. That hurts the networks, and the networks are going to be negotiating new TV contracts with golf in 2 years. Attendance, internet traffic all drop when Tiger doesn't play. I think this is going to be a giant story, of course, when Tiger does return to the golf course. The multi-million dollar question is whether fans are going to care about him in the same way as a golfer as they did before all of this happened.
Thank you, Stefan. Have a great weekend and a good holiday season.
Thanks, Robert. You too.
It's Stefan Fatsis, author of A Few Seconds of Panic, a sports writer plays in the NFL. He joins us most Fridays.